I learned that you start with three phases of leadership, right? First is I did it. Then you become a leader of a team, and then it's we did it. And then you become a leader of leaders, and then you have to delegate, and so it's they did it.
You're listening to the ISF podcast for your organization's better cybersecurity. Your host, ISF CEO Steve Durbin, is an expert in leadership, business culture transformation, and cyber strategies for today's top enterprises. I'm producer Tavia Gilbert. Today, Steve speaks with Rear Admiral Brian Luther. After more than 30 years in the U.S. Navy and at the Pentagon, Brian is now president and CEO of the insurance firm Navy Mutual. He talks with Steve about what he learned about leadership in his time commanding an aircraft carrier in the Navy, and how he has translated those skills into working in the private sector. He and Steve also discuss how leaders can move from a tactical mindset into a logistical one, and how to prepare your team for worst-case scenarios.
Brian, great to see you. Thanks very much for making time to join me on the podcast today.
Thanks, Steve. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, you've had a very interesting career. So you were in the Navy for a number of years. You were the commanding officer of the USS George H.W. Bush. You've also spent a lot of time at the Pentagon as latterly the budget officer for the Department of the Navy. So very impressive naval career. And now you're the president and CEO at Navy Mutual. So quite a big shift, I would have thought. A lot of people, obviously, in our industry, in the cyber industry, do begin their careers in the military. I'm intrigued to know how you found that shift, moving from such an illustrious career in the Navy into the private sector. How did you deal with that? Because that's a question I think that a lot of people are keen to hear about.
So one of the things about serving in the military is there are so many things the military does that you can explore your passions, or sometimes you're thrust into a position where you find that you actually have a skill. So I started out as an aviator, and I flew for 20 years before I went into the ship driving, the aircraft carrier, and senior command mode. But in the Navy, you have a sea job and you have a shore job. And so I got offered a job in the Pentagon as a comptroller, and I didn't know what a comptroller was. So I went to my commanding officer, and he said, take it. Any job in DC that deals with money is a good job. So I went and I became a comptroller, and you know, I had an affinity for the numbers, and it turns out it's a subspecialty for the Navy. And so I just went back into the comptroller field, I worked on the Hill. I was, I'll put air quotes around it, a lobbyist. I engaged with the appropriation committees, House and Senate, for the budget for the entire DOD. That's what helped me get the budget officer of the Navy. But the other aspect of it is, when I was a young officer, I got taken advantage of by a rather unscrupulous firm. And so I lost a bit of money. But what I really bothered me more was the time, because it's not market timing, it's time in the market. And I lost years of building up savings for my retirement because these people were taking advantage of me. So I got a passion for financial literacy. So when you take this comptroller and learning about money, getting your MBA and the passion for financial literacy, Navy Mutual, as a nonprofit that does financial literacy, does do investments in the form of annuities or life insurance to protect your family. And then we're the oldest veteran service organization. It allowed me to continue to serve and then continue that passion to educate people so they can take care of themselves rather than having somebody take advantage of them.
Right. And my perception, public service, fairly structured, private sector, maybe not so much. I know a lot of the issues that people talk to me about who are making that transition is they feel as if it's not quite the Wild West, but there isn't some of those guardrails that you become used to. Yes. How did you deal with that?
Well, it's very funny. I call it the warm embrace of the military, because they do, you know, this is your medical, this is your dental, this is what you do, this, and then you show up. And in the Navy, you know, we buy coffee in the squadrons. We call it the coffee mess. And every month you chip in money for the coffee that you buy. So I show up at Navy Mutual, and I'm drinking coffee every day, and I'm feeling guilty because I haven't given anybody any money for the coffee I'm drinking. So I went up to a fellow employee and I said, hey, who do I see about the coffee mess? And they're like, what? And I said, the coffee mess. And they go, there's a mess. We need to clean it up. We'll go get. And I'm like, no, how do I pay for my coffee? And we were just talking right by each other. And so, no, we provide you your coffee. And so, you know, it's a journey of learning for the military member. You go to HR. There's always people willing to explain everything. But you have to come in willing to learn. Because there's so much you have to do to take care of yourself. And people will educate you, but in the end, you're responsible for taking care of yourself. So you have to get educated, do your research, and then make those choices. You know, FSA, disability, insurance, all the things the military takes care of, you need to learn. As a, you know, in my case, you know, a 50-year-old, it was the first time I had to fill out any forms for medical.
Right. Very different. Now, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about leadership, because obviously I mentioned that you'd been the commanding officer on a number of ships. And I think I saw that George H.W. Bush had something like 5,000 people on board.
When you take all the staff, the ship's company, the staffs, the air wing, yeah, there's about, we peaked out at about 5,000 people, where it's a city at sea. Absolutely.
Right. So some of the leadership tips that you might have for people listening to this, because one of the challenges that people always talk to me about in the security field is how do they manage to, yes, lead, but perhaps more importantly, influence to achieve their objective. And I would imagine that in your career, you've had to do a fair amount of that, particularly with working at the Pentagon and on the Hill, as you say.
Right. You know, I have a couple of adages I found that the more senior you got, I learned that you start with three phases of leadership, right? First is I did it. Then you become a leader of a team, and then it's we did it. And then you become a leader of leaders, and then you have to delegate. And so it's they did it, right? And so when you're in the I did it stage, you're learning, you're getting your game up, the technical specs. This is where you establish your professional competence, right? And then being a leader of a team, the first thing, you know, I would say I lead with trust, but in order to lead with trust, you have to train, right? So if you're going to empower people to do something, you have to train them so that they know very clearly what the expectations are and they have the capability to do it. Because if you want to empower and push down, but your training doesn't rise to that level, there's going to be a gap, right? And nobody wants to fail in whatever they do. So they want to be properly trained. And then if they do well, they want to be recognized. I would say the leader shines brightest with reflected light. So you're setting these people up for success. And then when you're in that final stage and you're delegating, you have to very clearly, we call it commander's intent. You have to very clearly articulate to the people, you know, what you want done. And if it's very specific, you say, I want this done. And if it's generic, you say, I want this outcome, right? You can't say, I want a general outcome when you have something specific in mind, because they're going to go off and do it whatever way you want. But if you're very clear, I want this done this way, or I just want this outcome, and you let them, you know, you decide, you delegate, disappear, you'd be amazed at what people can do. And like, for example, on an aircraft carrier, I couldn't be, there's 3,000 spaces in an aircraft carrier. You can't be everywhere, right? So you have to train them, you have to trust them. And then once they see the success, it becomes a virtuous cycle and people want to keep winning. And that's just how I did it. A thousand ways to skin the cat.
Let's talk a little bit about different generations. A lot of talk in the industry about the challenge of millennials, Generation Z, you know, them viewing work differently, the mix of talent with the different generations. In your experience, is there really a generation clash going on here? What have you seen?
I think they're different, but I think fundamentally they're all the same. Like, I'm a boomer. Maybe I did things earlier in life, and the millennials and the Xers or Zs, they did it a little bit later in life. But I still see people, you know, wanting to be successful in a career, getting married, having kids, want to protect their family, you know, take care of it and stuff like that. And you're right. And so sometimes the younger kids coming into the military, maybe they didn't have a moral framework, or maybe they weren't challenged. And so you had to, you know, figure out how to communicate. But even inside a baby boomer generation, there were people that could take criticism or couldn't take, you know, constructive feedback or not, right? And so you always had to figure out, how do I best communicate with this person and get my message across? And so it's the same thing with the different generations. I try to boil it down to, you know, baseline. Why do people serve? Why do people come in the military, right? Purpose and meaning. And so I ask myself a lot, you know, what makes for a meaningful life, right? And so whether it's a Gen Z or a baby boomer, people who come in the military or even here at Navy Mutual, which is a nonprofit, they want to be part of something bigger than themselves, right? So it gives them some purpose, why you get out of bed in the meeting. And as I mentioned earlier, they want to be good at something. And if they are, they want to be recognized. The final thing is, you know, we call it work-life balance, but I would say people want time in their life for someone or something you love. And so if you take those three things, right, and you say, hey, you're serving, your actions are taking care of others, that provides meaning for your life, it doesn't matter which generation is, because those are threads that are woven through every generation and people, that it all resonates with them. And so I really didn't have to worry about the talks like, you know, if you don't have a pen, find a boomer because he has two in your pocket. And you know what I mean? There's just different things. I just tried to find something that was common to every generation. And then that was our North Star. That's what we were all working towards.
Now, in your career, you've obviously worked in a number of somewhat volatile areas, I would imagine, geographically speaking. Yeah. What would be some recommendations that you would give today for business leaders that are transacting international business, perhaps have teams or offices or near, you know, areas of conflict?
You know, similar theme. I found that, and I did go, I forget how many deployments, a dozen probably, and I was East Coast and West Coast deployments. So I was in Europe, I was in Asia, and I've been multiple countries. And, you know, fundamentally, people are the same everywhere, right? But you can't go to a country with your cultural prism looking through your eyes. Whenever we went somewhere, we always tried to understand, to avoid that ugly American stereotype. And there's different challenges, there's different cultures, and you need to go in understanding how to interact with those people, whatever country it is, and understand their custom and their mores, right? So that you're not imposing your conduct or behaviors that are inappropriate. And there's, you know, the stories are legion of people, you know, translating a phrase in their country and then applying it in another country that means, you know, nothing at all. Like Hillary Clinton did famously with the reset button with the Russians, right? So if you go with the intent to learn and engage people in their way of doing business or their, I think you'll find that people are always willing. And we did, you know, community relations, you know, we in the Navy, we always felt like we had an ambassadorial duty wherever we went. And frequently, you know, people would ask us, why are you here? You know, we'd work on orphanages or, you know, construction projects or any community relations project, how to help out the local people. And they all had an impression of an American, but they had never met an American either. And so if you go there and give them an opportunity to see you as just who you are and learn them just as they are, you find that there's more in common than people would give credit for. So I would always say, you know, before you go internationally, take some time to learn where you're going and respect the culture that you're going to be operating in.
Good advice. Now, sadly, over the past couple of years, if not more, we've seen quite a significant impact on global supply chains for a variety of reasons, not least the war in Ukraine, but other issues as well around Taiwan, China, and so on. And a lot of businesses have struggled to really get their arms around these supply chain vulnerabilities. Any advice you can give business leaders who might be listening to this on how to really secure that supply chain, really understand some of the challenges that they're facing with it?
Well, sure. You know, remember when I was mentioned earlier that I did it, we did it, they did it, right? Well, right. When you're a junior officer, you're all about tactics, right? And then when you're in like a squadron command, you're all about operations and how do you move a couple different pieces. But when I was an admiral, you know what I cared about? Logistics, right? And so it doesn't matter if I can get to the fight, if I don't have gas in the airplanes, bomb, butter, bullets, right? If I can't feed the people or fight with what I have on hand, then I'm absolutely useless. And so at that senior level, you have the strategic view, that 50,000 foot view, if you will. And if you don't understand your chains and where your weaknesses are, you can't fully execute logistics. So I find that a lot of people get stuck in tactics because that's where they came up. That's where their strength is, right? And they focus too much on the tactical instead of, hey, here is my logistics chain. And then what if the scenario, what if the this doesn't show up? What happens if a ship doesn't make port? What happens if the, you know, the components I need for my production facility don't arrive? And it's the lack of what if and the supply chains. And that's where they create the single point failures. So I always had, you know, a primary and then a secondary method. And then there was always something in my back pocket that I was always thinking about flexing to a third, right? Because in the end, my bosses didn't care. They just wanted, wherever I was at, they wanted me to execute the mission. And that, right. That's all they were asking me for. Did you do it or not, right? And so I'm the one that needed to understand what all the inputs were for my success. And then the senior leader is the one that should be held accountable for ensuring those continue.
So really having strong situational awareness, clarity on what's going on that's going to impact some of those issues that we've just been talking about.
Yeah.
And then a back pocket or backup plan for when it goes wrong, I guess.
Right. Well, Eisenhower is famous for saying it's not the plan, it's the planning, right? And anytime you're in, you know, any kind of military or business strategy, everybody else has a strategy too. So if you sit there and say, here's my strategy, and you execute in a linear fashion, you're ignoring the fact that the competition is observing you and they're reacting. And your strategy has to be savvy enough to say, oh, here's a change to my plan. Now I'm in a branch or SQL. And it's this move, counter move, move, counter move. And so if you write a 3 to 5 year strategic plan and you say, okay, my strategy is set, and not appreciating the fact that industry is moving, and especially post-COVID, right? I mean, a decade's worth of digital acceptance in a couple years, right? I mean, things change so fast. The consumer changed fast. And if you're operating in 3 year, you'd just be coming out of your 3 to 5 year strategic plan. If you were executing the way you were pre-COVID, post-COVID, you know, the competition's eating you for lunch at this point.
Absolutely. Now, one of the things that certainly our members all around the world have been spending a lot of time on in 2024 is crisis management strategies. How do they respond to the day when perhaps they have a breach or something untoward happens? So preparing for the day when they have to protect the company and mitigate impacts in case of some of the things that could happen. What are the aspects of preparation for that kind of eventuality that you consider most important and perhaps also secondary question, least considered?
So I have a saying, it always makes my staff squint, right? Because I have all these sayings and stuff. But I say to them, the first time you do something shouldn't be the first time you do something, right? And then they kind of, you know, that doesn't make any sense. So we'll use cyber, for example. So I came here and, you know, I start reviewing the crisis response. I'm like, when's the last time you did a drill, right? And so I made them do a tabletop drill. And now, I'm a boomer. I have a pen in my pocket, and I print things on paper. So the first thing we do in the drill is I took their drill, and I got online, and I found an actual hack. And then I replicated something that had happened to a company. So I created a timeline of it. And so now it's not what they've, you know, done a dozen times. It's something completely new. And then it kind of flummoxed them. So I'm like, okay, what do we do, team? What do we do? And I started creating the sense of urgency, which is not what you want to have in one of these crisis responses. You want to be take your time, wind your watch. And so they said, we need to shut down everything. And I'm like, is that what we need to do? And to protect the member, we need to shut down everything. And I'm like, okay, so what I'm hearing right now is the decision is to shut down the whole kit and caboodle. And they said, yes. And I said, okay, at 11:01, whatever, we shut down everything. Okay, well, what's the next step in the crisis response policy? So they saw, look at their computers. I'm like, nay, stop that. Shut your computer, right? Everything's down. We have nothing available to us. Now, what do we do? What's the next step? Nobody had any clue. So I went in my office. I brought out my binder of the policies. I opened up that old hard copy, and it was like this epiphany for them, right? And I said, when you make these decisions that take out everything, you have to think through the consequences. That was probably the most significant learning point for them. It wasn't the fact that I had a binder of the policies, and it was like they didn't take it as a gotcha. It's they hadn't thought through the second and third order effects of a decision because they were trying to solve an immediate problem and they weren't thinking of the big picture. Think again, the logistics. So you can't do that just talking about it. Sometimes you actually need to execute, right? And then see where the friction points were, or I thought you were going to do this, or I thought you were going to do this. And just having a tabletop and having everybody explain what they were going to do, and having everyone understands what they can count on somebody to do, that's where you see where your gaps are. And then you update your process. But like I said, it's not the plan, it's the planning. You got to keep doing this as a repetitive measure so that when it does occur, you're prepared to do it.
Are we over-dependent, do you think, Brian, on technology?
I hate to be a geek, but did you ever watch the sci-fi show Battlestar Galactica?
Uh-huh. Yep.
So do you remember the big battle scene where the Cylons start it and they do this, they're all the Vipers are there and you're getting all excited for this big battle and you're like, this is going to be great. And then they push a button and the cyber attack goes and all those Starfighters or Vipers, they were called, they all just start floating. And then the Cylon, the bad guys, just to win. So you go from this climactic battle that you expect to have, and then there was a vulnerability that was exploited and the opposing force took complete control over it. So there are tremendous benefits associated with technology, but any strength pushed too far is a weakness. And I used to, when I was an admiral and I was briefing my different commanders, I showed that clip, right? Don't be over-reliant on something and you put all your eggs in that one basket and you lose it and then you don't have a second or a third option, right? You should be asking yourself, what if I lose this? What if they figure out a way to foil that? Because remember, we put something out there and in a strategic competition, there's move, counter move all the time. So understand, how you're using it, understand where your vulnerabilities are and anticipate that. So to your point, right, if all my business is done and then I lose all my debt, I get ransomware or I get hacked and I get shut down, denial of service, any of those things, is there reputational risk? Did I lose business? So use it as a tool, but don't be totally dependent on it, that if someone takes that tool away for you, your whole organization collapses.
One final question for you, Brian, and it's one that I get asked a lot by chief information security officers. What are some of the things that they can do in order to communicate some of the messages we've just been talking about to their board of directors, or perhaps to their chief executive officer who may not be as familiar with some of the things we've just been touching on here?
The way I do it is, as I mentioned before, I try and find a consistent theme because, for the CIO or for the board or for the employees, right? It's the same message up and down, right? So if your staff doesn't understand how they fit together and how their actions can have consequences, they'll do something sometimes out of ignorance, right? Nothing malicious. They just didn't understand the consequences. Same for the board. If the board doesn't understand why you need to invest in this or why this is important and they take the focus away, information security in this data world, in this digital world, it's table stakes, right? But it's table stakes for the board to provide proper oversight, and it's table stakes for your employees, right, to follow your rules. Because in either case, somebody not understanding, not being properly aligned can create difficulty for the business, right? So the consistency of messaging for the CIO and alignment of why these things are important, it's a constant education, I think, right? And you can't change it to the latest thing. You have to have these core tenets that you keep repeating and repeating and repeating, because if you're inconsistent over time, you lose your credibility.
Right. So consistent education, certainly having, I think, markers along the way so that you can check on the progress that you're making.
Sure. Right.
And, be adaptive and adaptable to the situation in which the business finds itself, I guess.
Absolutely.
Brian, been a real pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for sharing some of your insights and experience, particularly from your Navy career. And hopefully our listeners will have seen how some of those are as pertinent today in the business world as they were in the naval environment. So thank you very much for sharing those insights.
Thank you, Steve. It was a pleasure. Have a great day.
Thank you.
Special thanks to this week's guest, Rear Admiral Brian Luther. In the meantime, if you enjoyed today's episode, please take a moment to rate and review the podcast, and we'd be pleased if you'd consider sharing the episode. To become a member, get in touch with Steve directly at steve.durbin@securityforum.org or on LinkedIn. Check out all our media and resources. All of it is there to support you at securityforum.org. Don't miss our other podcast, Dear InfoSec, sharing conversations with members about the real-world applications of ISF research. The ISF podcast is produced by Talkbox Productions and Tavia Gilbert. Thanks for listening.